Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In 1993, in his hometown of Corpus Christi, Texas, Brett Anthony Johnston watched on live TV as flames engulfed a number of buildings in Waco full of men, women, and children during the FBI's siege on the Branch Davidian compound. 30 years later, the drama of that scene would inspire We Burn Daylight, a novel of star-crossed lovers set in a doomsday cult on the Texas prairie that asks, what would you sacrifice for the person you love? Brett Anthony Johnston is the author of the best-selling novel Remember Me Like This and the award-winning Corpus Christi Stories. It is a great pleasure to welcome Brett Anthony Johnston to this week's book show. Brett, thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to have you on the program.
Joe, thank you for having me, and I'm a huge fan of the show, and I feel like at any moment you're going to realize you invited the wrong person, so I'll understand if you cut the mic.
Nothing could be further from the truth, but I have to say that I was fascinated by the story itself, but of course what led to it, and I guess I'll turn it over to you to explain what drew you to want to tell this story. And to tell this story in this particular manner?
There's a number of things that have led to anything that anybody writes, and that's certainly true here. You know, there's been so much written and produced in terms of documentaries and television shows. There's been so much out there about Waco and David Koresh, especially. It doesn't leave much room for the imagination. And I'm a writer that if I know how a story ends, I'm really not interested in it. I crave surprise as a writer and as a reader. And so if the story doesn't have the potential to surprise me, I'm not going to sign on for it, whether I'm writing it or someone else is. And so the thing that really drew me to this was I had never really seen anything about an experience like this from the periphery, from people who are being consumed by it, but are not the typical people who you see with when this story is played out. That was the way in. It was the characters, and they just continued to surprise me. So I kept following them through this tragedy.
But you didn't want the main character to be David Koresh. You wanted it to be David Koresh-like.
I didn't want it to be David Koresh because I feel like there's so many amazing books and films out there that seem to me to do an amazing job of laying out who David Koresh was. I was interested in a different version of that. The guiding light for me was not so much the historical accuracy or the actual lived events. The guiding light for me was the place and these imagined characters. And this quote that comes from the novelist E.L. Doctorow, who said, "The historian will tell you what happened. The novelist will tell you what it felt like." And I think that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to render what this might have felt like for these people. And I'll leave David Koresh to the historians.
With that said, how important, and you just touched on this, but how important was the accuracy in the sense of the overall accuracy, not what happened perhaps on any given day or at any given time, but the overall accuracy?
I felt very beholden to a kind of emotional accuracy. I hope I got that right. I hope that there is a sense of authenticity. But in terms of accuracy in the historical context or the lived experience of these actual events, that was pretty much an afterthought to me. And I've tried to signal that to the readers from the very first line of the book. You know, the very first line of the book mentions the March fires, whereas everybody who's familiar with this horrible event in American history. Everybody knows that the fires took place in April. So I'm trying to suggest to the reader that this is going to be a different story than what you have heard, and it is going to divert from the historical record. I'm interested in the characters and the place and what kind of pressure they would exert on these characters that I really came to love throughout writing the book.
So one more question along this line, and then I'll move on. But the idea then to still have it set in Waco and in that setting, that was important to you.
It was. I made many trips to the Mount Carmel site, which is where the compound was, where the ranch was. And one of the things that never failed to strike me in a really profound way is how incredibly isolated that area is. It is really, really far from the city of Waco. On a good day, maybe you can get there in 20, 25 minutes. Usually it's closer to half an hour or so. And once you get out there, it is really, really almost nothing except fields and pastures. And, you know, they're dotted with farmhouses here and there, but it's so isolated. And once you see how small you feel out there, then a lot of the reporting and the narratives that were being perpetuated in 1993, that this group of people was a danger to society and they were going to overthrow the government or whatever was happening, it takes on a very, very different feeling when you're out there and you're surrounded by fields and open sky and that's it. So the place really, really does impress itself upon you.
I had the opportunity to visit there about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. It was before COVID. And I was so struck by it for the exact reason that you just mentioned. Not much has changed in that regard. And also the fact that there is still a presence, right? There's still a presence of the thought and the people who were there and why they were there.
That's exactly right. And who knows, maybe you and I were there at the same time and we just didn't know it. But I certainly made a trip out there around that same time. And I made a trip out there on the 25th anniversary of the day of the fires. A number of the survivors were there. There were other kind of activists. There were some of the religious scholars who were denied access during the siege were there. And so I listened to all these presentations. They had vendors set up. You could buy CDs of Koresh's sermons. It was a revelatory experience. And you're exactly right. There is still a very, very small, but nonetheless serious commitment to the people who died and who survived.
The name of the new novel is We Burn Daylight. It is published by Random House. Let us talk about the characters of this book and how you decide to tell the story. I'll begin with the two main protagonists, who are Roy and Jay. These are the characters who tell most of the story. They are young and they are on opposite sides, if you will, and you feel free to explain that. And also they come together. There isn't so much a development of that as there is a here they are and this is the situation that they're in.
I feel like the only thing that is unchanged about this book, and there were little tweaks, but the opening line that I mentioned a little bit ago, that was really the start of the book, and it's largely unchanged. There were so many clues in that line as to who Roy was. And for me, the way into Roy was to understand that he was a little a little fellow who was obsessed with lock picking. I just kind of trusted, okay, if I can figure out why he's interested in lock picking, then I'm going to figure out who he is. With Jay, one of her first lines is something to the effect of, "No one has ever called me Jay." And right there, there's, you know, there's a kind of layering. There's a sense of discretion. There's a sense of masking. There's a sense of there's more here than is readily accessible. And so I wanted to find out more about that. And I don't go into anything that I'm writing with any sense of what it's going to be or how it's going to play out. It's very much a sense of discovery for me. So all the ways that you're describing of them being on different sides of things, that was complete discovery. And I can say more about it, but it really was as much a surprise to me as it was to them. And I'm grateful to them for that.
Since you have referenced it, I would like to read the first line of the novel, which is, "In those raw first weeks of 1993, before my family broke apart and before the March fires, before the world turned its lurid attention our way, and before her and before everything else that changed me, I was 14 years old and learning to pick locks." We learn that Roy is the son of law enforcement, and then we later learn that Jay is someone that is inside the compound. And how these two characters come to know each other and meet each other is fascinating, especially given what is going around, right? What is going around them?
Yeah. Another aspect of this is that when I was growing up in Corpus and this thing was happening, we really got one story. And that story was that there's this crazy cult or commune and it has this horrible leader and they all live in this ranch and they worship him and he's doing all of these horrible things and they have these guns. And so the government has come in to try to save them. It wasn't until I was on book tour for the last novel, which was about 10 years ago, that I heard a gentleman, I believe I was in Houston, Texas at an event, and I heard a gentleman talking about having worked beside someone who lived at the compound and I think subsequently died in the fires, but he didn't know that they worked beside him, but they lived at the compound. So they were coming in and out of Waco every day to work at this job. And he didn't know what was happening in their life until he found out that this person had died in the fires. Now, this guy might be making it all up. But I've since come to learn that was not entirely uncommon, that some of the believers did have jobs in Waco. And so I started thinking, what would it be like to be in such close quarters with someone and not know what's really happening in their life? So I sat with that for a few years, and then I started thinking, well, what if it were not an adult? What if it was the new girl in school and you started to kind of develop a crush for her, but you didn't know what was really happening in her life? And so that's kind of how it started, with them being on opposite sides of this. It was really, you know, that age-old question of what if?
Because of their age, it tells you so much. It brings us back to that time in our lives when we were that age, and also what it would be like for us to be in an extraordinary, just unbelievable circumstance that so many adults are trying to figure out and quite frankly on all sides not doing that great of a job of it.
Yeah, I wanted it to reflect that time in your life where you're in this kind of liminal state where you think you know a lot, but you also realize that maybe you don't know enough. It felt like everything that befell these characters in the book, or every action that they took, had a different kind of consequence for them. And the hardest thing was resisting my urge to protect these two kids. I became very, very protective of them, and yet I had to let them go and do their thing. And I didn't know how it was going to end. And I would keep going back to that line, and I don't want to give anything away, but I kept going back to the line of where Roy says, "and everything else that changed me." That was a little kind of a tuning fork for me of like, okay, well, we need to follow this little dude and figure out what is he telling us. The hardest part was letting him find the trouble that he finds.
Brett Anthony Johnston is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is We Burn Daylight. It is published by Random House. There are many of us who live through that time and remember it. And we certainly have our notions and our thoughts and our gauzy memories of what happened. And yet, as we read this, we're allowed to sort of have a clean slate to understand. There isn't, and I hope you'll find this to be to be a compliment, but there isn't a manipulation as to how we should feel, because you're talking about kids. You're talking about kids who are trying to figure things out in the most extraordinary of circumstances.
You know, one of the things that I talk a lot about with students, and one of the things that feels like a kind of gold standard to me that I'm trying to reach in my work, is to come to the characters and this moment in their lives without any judgment. I try very hard, and I'm sure I fail all the time, but I try very hard to put the characters on the page in a full enough capacity for the reader to make judgments if they are so inclined. But I don't want any of the characters, whether it's Roy and Jay, or even to a certain degree someone like Perry or any of the law enforcement people, I don't want to put my finger on the scale. I want to try to render and animate them in such a way where the reader feels as though they have enough information to understand them. And if they're of this persuasion, to pass judgment on them. But if I go in to writing something and I have an agenda, or I think this person is good or bad, I won't write it, because it's uninteresting to me, and it feels, as you say, like a manipulation, and I'm not built that way.
It is also interesting to me that there is a foreboding, because of our knowledge, our general knowledge of the events that took place in Waco, a foreboding of what's going to happen to the overall scene within the novel. So we're preparing ourselves for that. And I think that helps us in rooting for this young couple as to how they're going to get through it, especially since they are also dealing with their own set of issues. In Jay's case, with her mother, and with Roy of his father and his brother, and just figuring out what is going on in a normal teenager's life.
I hope that the book feels like an authentic rendering of not just this massive, historic, international tragedy, but also in the smaller moments of what it feels like to be a part of a family, or to be in love for the first time, or to be walking around with your buddy who wants, you know, to break into the mall, and things like that. Those moments feel as important to me as the big pyrotechnics that we're all familiar with. I don't know if it was his idea or if he was quoting someone else, but the phenomenal novelist David Mitchell, I once heard him say something to the effect of, if you look up at the universe and you try to write about the universe, you're never going to write about the brick wall that's right in front of you. But if you write about the brick wall that's right in front of you, you're always going to write about the universe. And that feels like a mandate for me as a writer and for so many of the writers whose work moves me. I'm interested in those little moments that reveal who we really are.
As I mentioned in the very beginning, Waco, Texas, 1993, but the novel has such a contemporary feel. It doesn't seem like it's bringing us to 1993. This story could be told today or about 2 years from now or 2 years ago.
I hope that's true. I'm a very, very slow writer, and I find writing impossibly difficult. It is by far one of, if not the most difficult thing that I've ever tried to do. When writing is this difficult and you take so long to write a book, people will ask you things along the lines of, like, why are you still interested in 1993? Why, with all of this stuff out there, why do this? Why kill yourself over this? And I think it's that question that you just kindly asked, which is, or your position, which is, it doesn't feel like 1993. It feels like this could be happening now. And I think one of the reasons why we're so interested in it, not in my book, I hope people are interested, but just in this subject, is that I don't think we really yet understand what happened in 1993. Again, I'm not talking about, did the Davidians fire first, or did the ATF fire first, or was Koresh guilty of this or that? I don't, those things are, other people can sort those out. I'm saying, like, I don't think we really understand how something this ugly and terrifying and heartbreaking and preventable, this was so preventable. How could we let this happen so close to home? It just doesn't add up. And I think we keep looking for different variables and different solutions and until something clicks. But I don't know that anything is going to click. I don't know that, you know, ironically enough, that there's some new revelation that is going to come and say, that's all in the past. We've learned nothing from Faulkner. It's that the past ain't never dead, and it's not even the past, you know? So I hope there's an element of relevance even for us, for something that is set in 1993.
One of the things that brings us to current day is your use of, and I use this as the positive term, but the device of the podcast. Throughout the novel, we are brought to snippets of a podcast that looks at this time and this place and gives us the viewpoints of various individuals who were there at that time. That does give us a contemporary feel as well, in also reminds us that 30 years later, these people are still trying to figure it out, or they have very strong feelings and they've become much more concrete in the three decades that have taken place since.
The interesting thing that I can say about the podcast is they were never supposed to be in the book. As I said, writing is so difficult for me, which is certainly part of the appeal. But if I have any gift as a writer, it's that I've never expected this thing to be easy or fast. I'm constantly trying to find ways to make this thing more manageable. So I started doing interviews, just fictional interviews, as a way of understanding the story more strictly for myself. I was trying to figure out, okay, who's still alive in 2024. I was trying to figure out, exactly as you said, how do these people who were touched by this, whose lives were upended or defined by this moment, how do they feel about it today? It was almost a kind of calisthenics. And I was just doing these interviews and for my own benefit. And I was talking with one of the editors of the book, and he said, well, why don't you let me see some of those? And I did. And then he said, we should put these in the book. I'm talking about the editor, Mark Warren. And he had such a huge impact in shaping this book. It would not look this way without Mark Warren. Because I trusted him so much, I did it. And so they kind of existed in this interview format, but I had never given any thought to, and I don't want to give away any spoilers, but I had never given any thought to who was doing the interviews. And so up until about 2 or 3 weeks before the book went into galleys, I had found out who was doing the interviews, but they were not podcasts. But at that time, we were debating what the title of the book should be. I just thought how silly and stupid it would be if we called it On the Lam. And that felt to me like it would be the name of like a cheesy true crime podcast. And so I put that in there almost as a kind of like joke. And yet here we are. Who knew?
And the book ends up being titled We Burn Daylight, of course, from Romeo and Juliet.
The book went through many, many titles. When we were trying to decide what it should ultimately be called, I pitched that one. My editor, Andy Ward, who is brilliant and so thoughtful and so helpful and has done so much for this book as well, he wrote back and said that he really liked it. And he said, it sounds James Salter-esque.
Again, Brett Anthony Johnston's new novel is We Burn Daylight. It is published by Random House. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.